A turning point for Nigeria? Maybe. Today, Thursday, May 8th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Nigeria's president now promises to find the girls kidnapped by Muslim extremists 3 weeks ago. Their abduction has put the government under intense pressure, but it's also united Nigerians behind a common cause.
We have Muslims and Christians that truly, truly have the same mission, is for these innocent children to come back to us. We're waiting for them.
And later, a reporter finds himself face to face with some dangerous characters at a checkpoint in eastern Ukraine.
Without saying a word to me, pulled me out of the car, pistol whipped me on the head, kicked me on the chin, and only then asked for my documents.
Plus, you'll never guess where Italy's premier bike race starts tomorrow. That and more ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Nigeria's president would have preferred to talk about something else today, but as he greeted delegates to a World Economic Forum meeting in Abuja, President Goodluck Jonathan was forced to address the issue that's been hanging over him for the past 3 weeks, the abduction of more than 200 girls by Islamist rebels in northeastern Nigeria. Jonathan promised to find them, and he thanked the U.S., Britain, and other nations for offers of help. Secretary of State John Kerry says an American team is already at work in Nigeria. Still, anger at the slow response from Nigeria's government has been building, with increasing pressure coming from a popular Bring Back Our Girls campaign. One of its leaders, Fatima Zanagana, spoke with me from Abuja.
Right now, my sister, who lives in Maiduguri, just sent me a very disturbing WhatsApp message that they were told to expect American soldiers. And she's really freaking out because, you know, I'm sorry to say, no offense meant, but anywhere where there's a rescue mission going on, you know, we have a lot of innocents that go along with the mission. So they're really, really scared. But I try to reassure her that the Americans and the British and whom all the people that are coming to help are not there to harm anybody. They're there to end this nightmare for us.
So Maiduguri is in the north of Nigeria, and you're from the north yourself. Now, the girls, at least initially, were taken to the Sambisa Forest. It's a game reserve in northeastern Nigeria. Do you know whether Nigeria's security forces patrol in this area on a regular basis?
No. Even the girls that escaped, they said it, that even when they escaped and they were running for their lives in the forest, they didn't come in contact with a single person in uniform.
Why do you think the security forces don't go in there?
They don't have the equipment to go in there. These so-called Boko Haram, they are more equipped than them.
We've heard that local residents in northeast Nigeria are pooling money and searching this region themselves for the girls.
That's for a fact, I know. But they don't have guns. You know, during the first Boko Haram insurgency, when their leader was killed, the army and the police collected every gun. They announced that anybody that has any ammunition anywhere should submit it to the police. And if you are found with any kind of ammunition in your house, that means you're automatically one of them. So every single person that I know in Borno State, they gave their ammunition away.
We tend to think of Nigeria as divided between Muslim in the north and Christian in the south.
Anybody that's painting a picture of this division is a false story. Right now, even in Chibok, you have Muslims and Christians.
Chibok is the town that these girls were abducted from.
Yes, yes. It's a very small town, you know. And in Gwoza, local government, you have Muslims and Christians. Whereas in the south, too, there are Muslims and Christians mixed everywhere in Nigeria. And right now, I think it's a turning point for our nation because we have all sorts of ethnic groups there. We have Muslims and Christians that truly, truly have the same mission, is for these innocent children to come back to us. We're waiting for them. And for this to turn the face of our country in uniting us, not dividing us.
You left the north of Nigeria a year ago, you said. Had you been personally affected? Are you personally affected by Boko Haram?
Of course, yes. I've lost 2 cousins to this insurgency. In every family, there's a story to tell.
And this has been going on for several years. So why can't the government get it?
Since 2009.
Why can't the government get it under control?
You know, just picture a group of boys that are called Al-Majiris. They don't have money. They are not from wealthy families. They bring them in trucks and they dump them in Maiduguri under some clerics. You know, most of them just wash clean and they go around the streets begging to get money to take back to their teachers. We have child soldiers that are forced. You know, some of them, do you know, they actually send messages to their parents telling them they want out, but they can't because they are threatening their younger ones. They are threatening their old parents. So they have to stay and work for them. So there's a level of failure on all levels, really. It's very disheartening.
Dr. Fatima Zanagana, the founder of the Purple Heart Foundation and one of the leaders of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign in Nigeria. She joined us from Abuja. Thank you very much.
I hope I can help to end this nightmare.
Boko Haram has threatened to sell the kidnapped girls into slavery. That would suggest there's a market for slaves in Africa's Sahel region, which you might be surprised to hear actually does exist. New York Times columnist Nick Kristof has campaigned to highlight the issue of modern-day slavery in Africa. You focus your attention on Sudan and South Sudan, but just tell us how far slavery extends across the entire Sahel region, which goes from Senegal, really, almost all the way to Ethiopia.
Yeah, there's human trafficking across not only the Sahel, but in West Africa itself, in countries like Benin, Ghana, and so on. So there is certainly a market. It tends to be for younger children. And one of the constraints that Boko Haram would face in this case is that, people are willing to buy a small child because that child is not going to be able to escape. If you buy an educated 17-year-old girl and pay money for her, then she is going to be much more of a flight risk. And, you know, that's why it tends to be illiterate peasant boys and girls who are quite young who tend to get kidnapped and sold.
Can you generalize a bit about how this market works? I mean, literally the market. I mean, we think of slavery in the South, pre-Civil War, and people being sold off. I mean, is that what happens in this part of the Sahel?
Yeah, it tends to be somewhat less sexual slavery than it is in some other parts of the world and somewhat more kind of labor trafficking. So it'll be somebody who needs workers, and they will buy a small child, for example, for fishing or something else, or in other cases, for a wife. And they will, literally shell out money. And there's usually an intermediary. In some cases, the parents know about it and they're desperate for money. In other cases, the child is just kidnapped or the parents have been promised the child will get some kind of a more promising opportunity. And everybody is tricked.
Well, what is driving this? Is it economic? Is it power?
It's both. And it's also a lack of education, a lack of literacy, a lack of knowledge about the world, and indifference on the part of police. So when a child is kidnapped and is off in some village working in inhumane conditions, that child, if he or she is uneducated, may not realize that this is illegal, that they may not speak the local language, so it may be very difficult to get away. Even if they can, they don't know where to go. They don't know how to get home. And so they become prisoners of circumstances. Or if it's a girl who's been married off, they may feel that once they have been raped by their new quote-unquote husband, that they no longer will be able to find a husband or a partner ever again, that they've been shamed for life and that their other opportunities are destroyed. So all these ways of thinking, if you will, imprison people and make the system vaguely enforceable.
I mean, slavery as a practice is centuries old in this part of the world. I was in Mali a number of years ago with two musicians, fairly modern thinking people. One of them was from the north of Mali, the other from the south, and the one from the north said, you're my slave. He was joking, but this is this old cultural thing. Do you think the cultural link to slavery is going to be a tough one to erase?
You know, I think that the cultural one in most of the region is easier to erase than the sort of economic and other forces. I mean, people don't necessarily think of it as slavery, but women are devalued, wives are devalued, peasants, especially from some social classes, are completely devalued and are seen as not having rights. And the legal system just doesn't work if you are poor. And so it's those kinds of the infrastructure of society that is lacking in those places.
So do you think this threat from Boko Haram to sell these schoolgirls, is it a credible one? Or could some of these girls have already been sold off in a place like Chad or Cameroon?
They could have been, and it is a credible threat. But I'm hoping that it isn't going to work as smoothly to sell these girls as Boko Haram might think.
The New York Times, Nick Kristof, thank you very much for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
What is pink and woolly, goes ba, and is transfixed by 400 wheels? A sheep. A sheep watching the Giro d'Italia, Italy's premier cycling event. We'll explain about the sheep in a moment. The Giro d'Italia is one of the world's biggest races after the Tour de France, and it gets underway tomorrow. Nearly 200 riders will cover nearly 2,000 miles, cycling like mad every day for the next 3 weeks. But here's a geo quiz for you, taking us back to that sheep. Where does the race begin? The starting line. Malachy O'Doherty is a writer and loves cycling. Tell us where the race is starting, Malachy, and what's up with those pink sheep.
The race is starting in Belfast, Northern Ireland. It's starting at what we call the Titanic Quarter, which was built to commemorate the sinking of the ship, the Titanic, in 1912. We have a lot of pink sheep here. You mightn't have known this before. This is Northern Ireland. We have a lot of pasture land, and we have all gone crazy about the Giro d'Italia, which is distinguished by the pink jersey given to the winner. We are dyeing our sheep pink, and we are all wearing pink shirts, pink trousers, and I'm sure some people are even wearing pink underwear.
Pink everywhere. We've still got this question. Why is it starting in Belfast?
It's a thing that they do. Previously they started from Denmark. I think certainly from the point of view of the Northern Irish, it's about promoting tourism. We are putting money into this. For instance, areas which are a little derelict with shop fronts looking pale and empty are being spruced up. Even empty buildings are being painted, all to create an impression of Northern Ireland as a bustling and busy and thriving economy with a vibrant culture. We hope that 800 million people will see the backdrop of Northern Ireland when they're watching the race, and they'll say, hey, I'd like to go there for my holiday. Part of the problem is, of course, it'll be raining.
Yeah.
We're right on the Atlantic here. We're the first stop for most Atlantic storms.
Now, Belfast is going to be a time trial race, then a loop stage around Northern Ireland. Where does the race go after Belfast?
After Belfast, it goes on Sunday to Armagh and then to Dublin. That crosses the border into the Irish Republic. I think the hardest stretch of all, though, will be the one inside Northern Ireland on Saturday, which takes us up through the Antrim coast area, the Glens of Antrim. Beautiful, beautiful coastal scenery. I mean, if it's a clear day, they'll be able to see right across to Scotland. But big hills, steep hills, incredible views of the North Atlantic.
Then finally, next week, the Giro d'Italia will actually go back to Italy.
It will actually go to Italy. Nobody here will be paying the slightest bit of attention to it.
Well, I was just going to ask.
This is a sports fixture, but this is not being appreciated as a sports fixture in Northern Ireland. If you stop people in the street and say, who do you reckon is going to win the race? They won't even know the names of the participants. I mean, it's an odd thing, this.
But, Malachy, you like cycling, so as a fan, are you going to follow the Peloton to Italy?
No, I'm not going to follow the Peloton to Italy. I will go and I will stand on the coast road in Northern Ireland and I will hope that the rain stays off and I will just watch them go whoosh, whoosh, whoosh past me and I will feel that I have made my contribution to the whole event. But if it's raining, they will see nothing but mist.
Writer Malachy O'Doherty, who lives in Belfast, where the Giro d'Italia kicks off tomorrow. Malachy, thank you.
Thank you. All the very best, Nick.
Later on The World, we go to China and ask, how's Mao now on PRI? I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good news for South Africa's ruling party, the African National Congress. According to results released today, the ANC easily won yesterday's general election there. That's despite efforts by some opposition parties to discredit the ANC during the campaign, describing the party as a century-old organization, now out of step with post-apartheid, post-Mandela South Africa. The ANC's roots go back to early 20th century when it was created by a man named John Dube. He was a publisher, essayist, educator, and politician. Dube's wife, Nokutela, also played a key role in the activism that led to the formation of the African National Congress in 1912. But most books about Dube and the ANC don't mention her. Sherif Keita is a professor and filmmaker at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. He's researched Nokutela's contribution to South African history, and he's made a documentary called Remembering Nokutela. Professor Keita, thanks for joining us for a few minutes.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Now, before you tell us about Nokutela and your research into what became of her, just give us a short backgrounder here. What was going on in South Africa in 1912 that triggered the formation of the ANC? Had there been no nationalist Black African Party prior to that?
No, there hadn't been. But I think the end of the Anglo-Boer War and the Union of South Africa in 1909, which really marked the coming together of the white factions, the British and the Afrikaners, together to create a peace, which was at the expense of the Blacks. That triggered, I think, a sense of nationalism among the Blacks, because they realized that if they didn't come together, just like the whites did, then they were completely done for. That's when the educated elite and the leaders, the traditional chiefs, got together and launched the ANC. The first president of which was John Dube,
right,
and formed in 1912.
And then you land on this narrative of Nokutela, his wife, that woman we've all forgotten, many of us have forgotten. What role did she play in his political growth, in John
Nokutela,
Dube's
political growth? Nokutela was key because I think they started first as educationalists. They wanted to bring an independent education to Black South Africans who were still living almost in bondage, you know, in relation to the whites. So they picked up on the ideas of Booker T. Washington, the famous African-American leader who started Tuskegee, but who himself had been educated at the Hampton Institute in Virginia, in the same spirit of manual trade, to give people a way to employ themselves so they wouldn't have to go beg the whites for jobs. When they picked up on the model of Booker T. Washington, they got his endorsement, and when they came to study in the U.S. here between 1896 and 1899, in Brooklyn, New York, that's when they started fundraising. So the two of them were a formidable fundraising team. John Dube would speak about the needs of the Black Africans for education, for enlightenment, and then Nokutela would sing after. She was the first Zulu woman to sing click songs in the United States.
Click songs, between just 18, like we know of Miriam Makeba's click
that's
songs.
That's right. In fact, I told that story to Miriam Makeba in 2002. I told her about Nokutela. She was blown by this Nokutela story.
Did she know of Nokutela before?
She knew nothing. Wow. She knew nothing about Nokutela. So she said, "Hallelujah! 50 years later, come little Miriam with her click songs." And I would say that these two women, between Nokutela and Miriam Makeba, I mean, they were key people introducing the struggle of the Black people in South Africa to the American audience.
So what happened to Nokutela? How is it possible that, you know, practically all memory of her has just disappeared until you kind of revive the story?
Nokutela is the poster person for the marginalization of women in South African history. Up to now, the role of women in the early stages of the struggle has been underappreciated. In the case of Nokutela, the fact that she never had a child, that made for a very unhappy marriage with John.
She was unable to bear children, is that right?
She was unable to bear a child. And after 20 years of marriage, after they had built so much, they had started this pioneering school. They had worked on creating a political party. They had started a newspaper together. They were creating all these groundbreaking institutions, but in their own private life, there was this pain. Because she could not have a child, I think John Dube did some things on the side. And it became a big scandal, so Nokutela felt betrayed.
Did she leave or did he reject
her? No, she left everything behind. In 1914, even in her own family in those days, she didn't get much support. Because a woman who could not have a child, I mean, it didn't matter what else you did in life. if you couldn't have a child, you would be forgotten. And this is what happened to Nkotela. So she died 3 years later, and she was buried quickly in Johannesburg.
And on her gravestone in Johannesburg, which you discovered, it's just a number, her initials, and the fact that she's Christian.
Yes, there was no gravestone by the time I discovered it. It was just plain ground. That's why the research took so long. It took almost 3 years. But when there was a mark, we don't know how long this mark stayed on the grave. It was just two initials, CK2973, which meant Christian 2973.
Right, K that's for the Kaffer, only mark, the South African
Christian
pejorative.
Kaffer, that's why. That was the only thing on that grave. And then that got corroded and then disappeared. So 2012, I gathered a family and we put a small plaque. And last August, with the help of the government and the province of KwaZulu-Natal, we raised a huge headstone on a grave.
So, Sherif Keita, what was it like for you, a man from Mali, thousands of miles from South Africa, a professor from Minnesota, and you come to these South Africans and you're filling them in on their own remarkable family history? What was that like for you and for them?
Well, it was just amazing. I mean, you know, seeing these women who were educated, who in fact were the ones that were keeping Nkotela's memory to a certain extent. They didn't have a lot of knowledge. So at some point, the generations decided that we need to immortalize this ancestress of ours. So one of the great nieces, her name is Nkotela. So the family tried hard to keep her memory alive. But I was the one who really could bring them the archival material to give them the definite proof that this is what our ancestress has contributed to the history of South Africa. And it gave them so much pride, because, I mean, apartheid meant to beat black people down. And believe me, it succeeded. These highly educated women really felt that something was missing to give them their sense of pride. And I think this is what the research brought to them.
So this revelation about Nkotela, the first lady of the ANC, can we call her, what have South Africans done with this knowledge that you've kind of dug up for them? Has it changed their own view of themselves, of how they view the ANC?
Change. Yes. In fact, not only the story of Nkotela, just last week, I found out that there is a new publication on the cover of which they placed Nkotela's photo and credited me for having found her grave. And the newspapers have started to talk about Nkotela now. And Nkotela's story kind of changed the narrative of the ANC and of South Africans on the centenary of their revolution. Because now President Zuma, in his speech, would make references to those missionaries who had never had credits before. And he even announced at some point my research on Nkotela.
Filmmaker and professor of literature at Carleton College, Sherif Keita, the man behind the documentary Remembering Nkotela, about the long-forgotten wife of the founder of the African National Congress. Sherif Keita, great to speak with you. Thank you.
Ngiyabonga kakhulu in Zulu, initshe inibaraji in Bambara. Merci beaucoup, Marco. Merci.
Thank you. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Today's China is hardly the country Chairman Mao envisioned.
Everything that the Chinese Communist Party stands for today, urban finance-driven types of development, is everything that Mao stood against.
How China airbrushes Mao's image, and later how cocktails get their fancy pants names. The stories ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's a chaotic time in eastern Ukraine. Pro-Russia separatists have taken over towns and government buildings throughout the region, and this weekend they plan to hold a referendum on possible secession from Ukraine. But we still don't really know just who these separatists are. Time magazine reporter Simon Schuster got a close-up look at the pro-Russia militias, much closer than he intended, really. Schuster, who speaks fluent Russian, was in eastern Ukraine reporting on the unrest when he ran into trouble at a checkpoint. We reached him in Berlin to ask him about what happened.
I was heading out of one of the towns that's considered rebel-held territory. I was alone in a taxi with the driver. And we stopped at a checkpoint, and one of the gunmen who was guarding the checkpoint was very agitated. In the vicinity of that checkpoint, there were pretty hot gunfights going on at that exact moment between the Ukrainian military and the separatist fighters. So they're very sort of nervous and jumpy. They searched the trunk and they found a flak jacket in the trunk that said press on it, clearly labeled. But because of that flak jacket, they must have assumed that I may have been a combatant of some kind. So without saying a word to me, pulled me out of the car, pistol whipped me on the head, kicked me on the chin, and only then asked for my documents.
So wait a minute. It said that you were press on the flak jacket, and that prompts immediately a crack on the head with a gun. I mean, that's pretty extreme.
Yeah, it is extreme. You know, the important thing really to remember in trying to figure out how that could happen is that the separatist fighters is sort of an umbrella term that encompasses so many different types of people, from regular criminals who are in this to gain possibly some loot. There are regular civilians, people who are mixed up in this, maybe volunteered to work as nurses or drivers. And then there are people with military training and military gear who are sort of leading the forces. And I happen to have the bad luck of getting one of the just a totally inexperienced guys, just a guy with a gun.
Mm. I mean, we've heard about the little green men, presumably Russian or Russian-supported uniforms without insignias. What was this guy wearing who cracked you over the head with that pistol?
He was wearing an Adidas tracksuit.
So this guy in an Adidas tracksuit pistol whips you, and then what happens? Where does he take you?
He didn't take me anywhere. They checked my documents, and then sort of it dawned on them that, wait a minute, this guy is probably actually a journalist, as he claims, and an American journalist. And they called their commander, who promptly arrived in a civilian car. So I think it was a Hyundai. And he was dressed in camouflage, so he was what you would refer to as one of the little green men. Mm. He was well-armed. He had a bandolier of shotgun shells across his chest, and he was quite irritated that they had, without reason or provocation, beaten up a journalist. That doesn't look good for them. So he took me back to the headquarters to confirm who I was, figure out who I was.
What's going through your head all this time right now?
How to get out of there, because it wasn't the first time that I'd been detained or kidnapped or whatever we call it. It was the second time. The first time was, you know, also scary. They released me after a couple of hours. And this time I thought, you know, maybe I'll actually have to stay in the basement for a while. Luckily, they didn't take away my cell phone. So I was able to put in a call to my Russian photographer colleagues and friends, who then began raising a stink among the separatists that we know there, that we've interviewed. So they called and vouched for me, and pretty soon I was released.
What did you do the moment they let you free, and how quickly did your editors know what was going on?
Right, because they allowed me to keep my phone, I was able to contact my editors pretty quickly. There was an odd situation with my release. I was sort of released halfway, so they apologized for the beating, and they took me to a safe house. It was sort of a hotel that belonged to their comrades. And they asked me to come back in the morning. And in the morning, right after sunrise, my Russian photographer friends came and got me out and drove me out of the town. And we later learned why they wanted to have me come back in the morning. We called them up on the phone. Actually, no, they called one of the Russian photographers looking for me. And the photographer asked, you know, what do you want with him? And they said, well, we caught the guy who hit me, and we want Simon to basically be present as we punish him. So I have no idea what they wanted to do with that guy or what that would have looked like, but that seemed to be their intention. I mean, trying to figure out their motivations there is sort of above my pay grade. I don't know.
Time Magazine's Simon Schuster. Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Remember last year the simmering dispute between China and Japan over those islands in the South China Sea? Well, there's another territorial dispute there that this week erupted into open hostility. This one's not between China and Japan, but between China and Vietnam. The two nations have sent ships to an area that both claim Vietnam says its ships were rammed by the Chinese vessels and sprayed with water cannon. China sees it differently. This isn't the first time China and Vietnam argue over who controls what in the South China Sea, but this is the most serious confrontation between the two countries in some years. The World's Matthew Bell is here in the studio to explain what's going on. Tell us about this incident, Matthew. What led up to it?
It goes back to late last week when China's state-owned oil corporation sent a giant oil drilling rig to that part of the South China Sea. We're talking about an area between Vietnam, Taiwan, China, and the Philippines near the Paracel Islands. Vietnam took issue with this. They said this is Vietnamese territorial waters. They sent a flotilla of ships. That's when the clash came. They say that Chinese ships rammed Vietnamese ships. They used the water cannon, as you mentioned. Yesterday, Vietnamese officials held a press conference. They showed videos. They're really sort of on the PR offensive here to kind of get their side of the story out and portray China as the aggressor.
And what is China saying?
They say that this is China's territory, that they're acting perfectly legally. They say that Vietnam is the aggressor here, that it was Vietnamese ships that were ramming Chinese ships. It all depends on whose side of the story you're listening to here. What's a surprise is that this thing has escalated so quickly. In fact, China and Vietnam a couple of years ago signed an agreement to deal with legal disputes in the South China Sea in a peaceful way through negotiation. All of a sudden, the tensions are ratcheted up, and we've got a real potential problem here.
So are these tensions between Vietnam and China indicative of something else? I mean, how old a dispute is this really?
It goes way back. As I said, the area sits between all of these countries. There are claims along these string of islands from Taiwan, from the Philippines. But in this specific region off the coast of Vietnam, the Chinese claim that this is their historic territory. They have maintained control since 1974 when Chinese and Vietnamese ships engaged in a deadly battle. The Chinese have controlled the area since then. Vietnam, on the other hand, says, no, this is off the coast of Vietnam. This is our historical territory. The important thing to know here, Marco, is that underneath this area south of the Paracel Islands, there's thought to be quite a lot of natural gas and oil. In fact, last year, ExxonMobil signed a $20 billion deal with Vietnam's state oil company to build a power plant in the region, if that gives you some indication of the potential here for business.
So whose maps are right?
I think it's sort of a legal question that hasn't been answered. I talked to a retired admiral earlier today who said, legally speaking, the Chinese can say with a straight face that they're not breaking the law by putting this rig in this area. But diplomatically speaking, this appears to really be a provocation on the part of the Chinese, and that's the position that the Obama administration is taking.
And what is the administration's take on all this?
The State Department issued a statement yesterday that comes down pretty squarely on the side of Vietnam. They criticized China for being provocative, saying that this was a unilateral move that's upsetting the status quo. The official U.S. position is that they don't weigh in on the sovereignty issue there, but say that any of these sort of legal questions need to be settled through negotiations.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
China's coming up on a big anniversary of an event that the government there seems determined to airbrush from history. That'd be the violent crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in Tiananmen Square 25 years ago, June 4th, 1989 to be exact. Then, as today, a huge portrait of the deceased leader Mao Zedong watched over the square. His place in history seems secure, yet China has come a long way from Mao's idea of a Marxist revolution for workers and peasants. Reporter Ruth Morris explores where Mao fits in today's China.
There's a new commercial development in Shanghai, the Jing'an Carry Center. It features glitzy retail and glassy office towers. Nestled in the middle, not far from a Ferrari display, there's a narrow two-story apartment. It was once the home of Mao Zedong, the founding father of the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, I'm Zhang Sheng. I'm a history professor.
Zhang Sheng is the historian who researched this site before it opened as a small museum. Mao lived here briefly in 1920, studying revolutionary movements and washing clothes to earn his keep. Zhang says the fact that Mao's old apartment is now wrapped in a mall goes to show how fast China is changing. Mao is officially revered in China, but Zhang says for young Chinese born after economic reforms took hold, Mao feels far away. All Chinese college students still have to take a semester of Marxist philosophy and Mao Zedong thought. In fact, Zhang has taught the class, but he says his students were less than enthusiastic.
They talked in the class, they laughed, they slept, but they don't listen to the lessons.
That's not to say Mao doesn't have his admirers. In remote Henan province at the Democracy School, revolutionary songs rouse students from their bunks at 5 a.m. Forty-nine-year-old principal Sha Zuhai counts as his pupils jog around the schoolyard, as if in a time warp, they run past portraits of Lenin, Stalin, and Mao. After that, it's off to the classroom, where they recite passages from Mao's little red book before breakfast. Sha says he wants to free his students from material desires and encourage them to serve the people. He says capitalism and greed destroy everything, including the environment. His school is dirt poor. There's no heating in the winter, no hot water, no indoor bathrooms. It's also very empty. More than half the classrooms are padlocked shut. Principal Sha says at its height, his boarding school had nearly 600 students. Today, there are just 18, some of them with learning disabilities. More and more families are moving to the cities, hoping for a piece of China's prosperity. Sha's school has become a relic.
The Maoist principles upon which the Chinese Communist Party came to power are no longer operative in China.
Rebecca Carl is an NYU history professor who's written a book about Mao.
Everything that the Chinese Communist Party stands for today, urban finance-driven types of development or so on, is everything that Mao stood against.
Carl says the Chinese who admire Mao today tend to be older people, nostalgic for what they remember as a simpler time. Others remember Mao as a dictator whose reckless campaigns led to the deaths of tens of millions from famine, purges, and repression.
There's four of us.
20 each.
Okay. Yes, 20 each.
Yang Peiming runs a museum dedicated to Chinese propaganda posters in the basement of a Shanghai apartment block. The posters depict adoring masses, smiling workers, bumper crops. Mao towers above the crowds, giving off light.
Mao is so mighty, and we needed somebody like a savior, and he appeared. Believe he's the god, he's the hero, and so then everybody just listened to him.
Yang's own father died in the custody of communist authorities in 1952. The family was told he committed suicide, but Yang never believed that version.
From that time, I don't believe anything, you know, because it's a big lie. It's a big lie.
Yang hopes his private museum will help visitors draw lessons from the past, but he also just wants people to enjoy the art. Independent of Mao and his mistakes, for Yang, this is an art collection. Rebecca Carl says what's happening in China happens all over the world. Foundational figures become unmoored from what they really stood for.
Mao has now become part of a national myth, and he then floats above history in a way that doesn't really require him to attach himself to history any longer.
Looking around Yang's museum with its splashes of revolutionary fervor, I suddenly notice there are only foreign visitors here. I ask Yang why he thinks that is. He tells me, it's because we're on TripAdvisor. For The World, I'm Ruth Morris in Shanghai.
You're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. This week marks a milestone for Canada. The country has installed its first ever marijuana vending machine. But before some of you run off and book flights to Vancouver, Chuck Verabayoff of the British Columbia Pain Society told TV channel Global News, you'll need more than your credit card.
If we had a card swipe system, it's open for abuse because then anybody could give their card to anybody else to use. This way you come in, you show the staff on duty, a membership to come in, and doctor's consent, and then you have access to it.
This is medical marijuana. You have to register for it. The machine looks like any other snack vending machine with the slow-mo delivery spirals, except it's got pot in sealed, tamper-proof bags. And critics say what's on the outside of those bags may be as much of a problem as what's inside. Lorinda Strang is with the Orchard Recovery Center, a drug and alcohol treatment facility in Vancouver.
I saw it on the news last night. And the first thing that I saw was a bag of marijuana called cotton candy, and that deeply disturbs me. If medical marijuana wants to be taken seriously, this whole movement, then they need to stop naming the drugs after candy for children.
The pot vending machine offers several types of marijuana, including the cotton candy. BC Pain Society's Chuck Verabayev says he hopes they'll soon have lots of the machines in the province.
We want to get our vending machines into every medical clinic and retirement home in Vancouver who want one.
So what else can you get from a vending machine these days? We've got a look at some of the other unusual stuff you can buy compiled by the CBC. Live hairy crabs, anyone? Yeah, really. It's at PRI.org.
How do cocktails get such evocative names?
Good question, Alina Simone. And since it's nearly the weekend, let's give Alina a shot at answering it. For that, she visited a New York City bar, pulled up a stool, and listened to the bartender's stories. Not just any bartender. This is a guy who's made it almost a second career to find out how certain cocktails got their names. Plus, he's named a few himself. Take it away, Alina.
We're used to the idea of bartender as therapist, a great shoulder to cry on. But bartender as poet, as historian, as multilinguistic wizard? I admit that I was guilty of my own prejudice until I met bar owner and cocktail consultant Joaquin Simo. Well, it turns out bartenders are always on the hunt for literary as well as libaceous inspiration, from iPod playlists to more old-fashioned sources.
One of the best ways to name drinks is just pick up a racing form, because someone's already done all the heavy lifting of thinking of a short, quippy, memorable name.
But sometimes the search for a name starts out with a hunch, an elusive kind of feeling. The perfect visual can help.
Sprezzatura is that great, like, Italian, almost like stylish, disheveled thing, you know, where you see like an Italian guy in an impeccably tailored suit and a perfect shirt, except his cuffs aren't done. These little details that you're like, is that on is kind of rackish and awesome and stylish, but I'm not sure. So, you know, we had this great drink, and, you know, I wanted it to be elegant and stylish and sexy, and so Sprezzatura Royale it turned out to be.
Okay, but what kind of name do you get by relying on your taste buds alone, without help from Twitter, sexy Italians, or racing forms? I decided to invite an expert to Pouring Ribbons, Joaquin's bar, my friend, stand-up comedian Eugene Merman. Spending a lot of time in bars has kind of made Eugene the equivalent of a foodie, a drinky.
Oh boy. There are three beautiful drinks in front of me. One has what can only be described as very valuable grass in it.
Eugene is trying two classic cocktails and one house original. The first two are a couple hundred years old, the last drink only weeks old. Unfortunately, the first name that Eugene comes up with can't be aired on public radio. Sorry, guys. On to drink two.
First of all, it's very good. It's very refreshing. I'm going to call it the Citrus Good Morning.
It's like what you'd pour on your feet to start your day, Eugene says. Turns out he wasn't far off. This classic cocktail is called the Corpse Reviver No. 2. It's one of a class of drinks intended to be consumed first thing in the morning to ward off the hangover. Good luck with that. Now with the last drink, the one with that stalk of valuable grass in it, better known as dill.
7 days in the grave.
Like that's what it tastes like?
It tastes like, yeah, it tastes like, you know, I can obviously taste the flesh. And it's not fresh, but it's not so old that you're like, yuck. I basically either named a drink or poorly described World War I.
7 days in the grave is a pretty awesome name, but Joaquin's is even better. The Bitter Taste of Calm. Turns out the story behind the name is just as memorable. Whenever one of Joaquin's business partners has to board a flight, he takes a pill for anxiety, which he grinds slowly between his teeth.
As he's chewing, he just looks and turns to the bitter taste of calm. And because there are so many things that are kind of bitter and savory in this drink, that name struck me immediately. I was like, we've got to name a drink after this. It's one of my favorite expressions. So that's where that name came from.
When you're naming a drink, nothing quite beats life experience, except maybe one's native tongue. Joaquin was born in Quito, Ecuador, and often looks south of the border for linguistic inspiration.
I'm a firm believer that anything in Spanish is going to sound better than anything in English. Like fork, bah, tenedor, that's elegant, you know, that's really cool. You know, beet, meh, remolacha, that's awesome.
But spiking a cocktail menu with Spanish doesn't always work. Take the time one of Joaquin's coworkers tried to update a Prohibition-era cocktail called the Monkey Gland.
Well, Monkey Gland does not work in Spanish at all. It actually, not that it sounds that great in English, but Glándula del Mono.
Then Joaquin wows me with another great factoid from his seemingly bottomless archive. The original Monkey Gland got its name from a dubious surgical procedure invented by Russian doctor Serge Voronoff, where grafts of monkey testicles were transplanted into guys hoping for a Viagra-like effect. Turns out that's another naming trick, Joaquin tells me. Get people thinking, if I order this, I'm destined for love tonight. I'll drink to that. If you're too old for dancing, get yourself a monkey gland. For the world, from New York, this is Alina Simone.
There's more from bartender Joaquin Simo in our language podcast, The World in Words. You'll find the stories behind such memorable cocktail names as The Colonial Affair and The 11th Hour. That's at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Bottoms up, and thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, by the National Endowment for the Arts, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Wachowski. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.